This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vandercoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
We're presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code DAN for a special offer when you sign up. That's code DAN, only at DraftKings Sportsbook.
Always enjoy talking to this guy. Always enjoy that he has takes that he's not afraid to give, no matter how it is that they land. A lot to cover with him, a lot of ground that I want to cover. So let's start, Buzz, and I admire your work, obviously, have for a long time, your writing in about various different subject matters. So let's start here. As a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, what do you make of the state of journalism right now?
Well, I mean, you know, I think there are exceptions to the sorry state. I mean, I think the New York Times has done an amazing job of, adjusting to the modern age. I think their online site is amazing. It's innovative. And by all accounts, they're doing well. The Post is doing okay. The Wall Street Journal. But then, you know, that's about it. Every newspaper is flagging. Newspapers are laying off. Some are going to 3 days a week. And I think it's only a matter of time here in Philadelphia when they'll go to 3 days a week. And it's scary. Now, I know we've been saying this for a long time, but I don't see it getting any better. The stories are shorter and shorter and shorter and more superficial, you know, than ever.
You won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative work on corruption in the Philadelphia court system that has only gotten more. I mean, what has happened with corruption and the weakening of newspapers, Buzz, I'm not even sure that this can happen today. You can win a Pulitzer Prize, but reporting on corruption is so run of the mill these days, and journalism is so weakened that I'm not sure that you would be allowed to exist in a meaningful fashion today.
I don't think so. I mean, Dan, that story with two reporters took 2.5 years. I mean, 2.5 years solid. Two reporters, 2.5 years, that would never happen today. I think the Philadelphia Inquirer, when I was there, now granted this was the early 80s, had a City Hall bureau of 6 to 7 people. I think there's maybe one full time. So you're not covering City Hall anymore. You know, you're picking and choosing and hunting and pecking. And the type of investigative reporting was done at the Miami Herald routinely. That was done at the Philadelphia Inquirer. That was done all over the country. You didn't have to be the New York Times. I think that's primarily gone. They just sort of, we have to go online. But very few papers have figured out how to monetize.
What do you regard as your greatest work?
Well, you know what? I'm going to be honest. Maybe this sounds self-serving. I think this last book, The Mosquito Bowl, is my greatest work. Will it be my most popular? You know, I doubt it. That's Friday Night Lights about high school football in Texas. This book took me 5 years. And, you know, for me, the test is, did you write the book that you set out to write? And I did. It's got a lot of moving parts. It's complex. It's not superficial, but I think it really tells not just a riveting tale, but a really, really important one to give memory to very young men who died for the cause of the nation in the Pacific War.
The Mosquito Bowl, a game of life and death in World War II. Why did you choose that as subject matter? These are giant investments. And when you've written Friday Night Lights, you have to be very careful about what you're going to choose to pour months and years into. Why this is the choice?
Well, you know, some have said, Buzz, you should have quit while you were ahead. Just that's it. I'm done. You know, I'll see you in heaven or hell. Look, I'm always looking for a great story. Great stories, they're hard to find. You're looking for narrative. You're looking for substance. You're looking for character. This hit me out of the blue after sort of 5 years of not having an idea. I was online and I read a little bit about this thing called the Mosquito Bowl. It was this improbable football game played between two regiments of the Marine Corps on Guadalcanal on Christmas Eve of 1944. They were stocked with great college football players. Some had played in the pros, 3 bona fide All-Americans, 7 captains from coast to coast, including Brown and Notre Dame. But the real upshot, what got to me emotionally, was of the 65 who played in this joyous game, 1,500 Marines came drunk, gambled. of the 65 who played, 15 were later killed several months later at Okinawa. And to me, that was a really, really riveting, perhaps wrenching dramatic story.
You just said, by way of passing, something that filled me with dark chill, 5 years without an idea.
They're really, you know, just for me, they're hard to come up with. There's a lot of gap between the books that I do. What often happens, and you probably can do this, you get an idea, you're really excited, you love it, and then a week later you say, no, it's just not going to hold the story. The narrative's not there, the storytelling's not there, the character's not there. And then once in a blue moon, basically, I can actually feel it inside me. I can feel my heart begin to palpitate. I get nervous. I get excited. This story struck despite a huge obstacle, which is all the men I were writing about were dead. Of the 65 who played, 64 were dead. And I said to myself, how the hell am I going to do this? Can I get anything? And then, you know, it's like reporting. You work, you get lucky. And I found that some of the men I write about four, had left a really, really good paper trail. Their parents had kept everything. So I said, all right, there's a way to portray these men from really the beginning of their lives through college to the Marines and then to the utter horror of Okinawa. And then what put me over the top was my father was there. My father was a Marine rifleman at Okinawa, which I didn't know until I did the book proposal. I knew he was at Okinawa. I didn't know where he was. I don't know what his rank was. And I went on the muster rolls. I said, what the hell? Let's see. There he was. We have the same name. My father in one of the regiments, the 4th Regiment, that I'm writing about. And that really freaked me out.
Just like that? You just discovered it?
Yeah. I mean, because he never talked about it. So I always figured, This is hands off. I mean, he doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to be reminded of it. He would joke about it a little bit and make light of it. And I remember asking him once, I said, Dad, did you have a rifle? Yes. Did you shoot? Yes. Did you kill anyone? He said, I wasn't going to look. What are you, crazy? I wasn't going to say, I don't know. I don't care. I know I fired it. And if it hit someone, that was great. But he was a pacifist. He hated guns. But you know, at that point in time, everyone served. It was the beauty of everyone, of any socioeconomic grouping coming together in unison to defend and fight for the country. And, you know, including my dad, he was at Dartmouth and then got drafted out of Dartmouth after his freshman year. I mean, he was 19 years old. I can't imagine. A lot of the guys I read about are early 20s or younger. How do they get off that transport to go to shore? What was within them? I kept saying, can I do that? I hope I could, but probably the answer is no. But they didn't see themselves as brave in the mosquito ball. It was duty. It was as simple as that. This is my duty, and I will see it to the end. I hope I live, but I may die.
Which process do you enjoy more, reporting or writing?
Oh, Jesus. Writing is great when it's rolling and when you have confidence. It takes a while to gain that confidence. There are a lot of false steps. You're really tentative at the beginning. You know, I try to write at least 1,000 words a day. Sometimes I'll write more. Sometimes I write less. I put something on the page. And then there are those horrifying moments where you feel, I'm stuck. I don't know where to go. There's no rhythm in the writing. The sentences are clunky. And, you know, you get over it. The research on this was a blast. This was all historical research, and I loved it. I never, ever tired of it because it's the ultimate reason to be a journalist for me. It's the hunt and peck. You have this massive material. And then for weeks, you're looking around, can I use anything? Can I use anything? And then there's a little strand over here and a little strand over there. And then it begins to pull together. I loved doing the research. And at the end, I think the book did gather together. A lot of moving parts. It was a huge puzzle, and where to put the pieces was a tremendous challenge.
You've lamented with us before doing the LeBron James book. Is it because the reporting couldn't be thorough? Is it because you knew you had to write around a bunch of stuff and you like giving the most authentic version of things?
Yeah, and you know what? I don't blame LeBron. You know, LeBron is such a physical specimen. You know, you think he's 35. I mean, he was, I think, 21 or 20. At the time, he was still with Cleveland. He actually wasn't that well-liked. A lot of people considered him kind of a punk. And he just wasn't into it. I basically got 2 to 3 hours. He didn't really care. And the worst thing was, Dan, we go to the gas station to get gas. He doesn't have his wallet. Maverick Carter doesn't have his wallet. I got to pay for the gas. You know, here I am, this little schlub reporter, and I'm paying for the gas. But he wasn't into it. And I just never felt like I got to the root of it. I never got to the root of him.
You say that you try to write 1,000 words a day. Doesn't mean you always write 1,000 words a day. But what's the last day that you didn't even try?
When I was doing the book, I mean, you know, except for, well, I would say every day I'm hoping for 1,000 words. But you know what? If it's a sentence, I'll take it. If it's two, if it's three paragraphs, because then you have something on the page. And so you wake up the next morning, at least you have something to manipulate, to play with, to massage. And you know this, there is nothing more terrifying when you wake up blank. There's nothing there. And I realize you got to put something on the page. And towards the end, of course, you got a deadline. Look, if we didn't have deadlines, nothing ever would be written. Let's face it, nothing. And, you know, towards the end, it began to flow. It began to get a rhythm. It was exciting. I like writing about people, you know, much more than process. But there is process in this book because I wanted to get across just what the Marines faced in the Pacific with amphibious assault. And so I do segue. I write about the draft. And contrary to what we believe, we had a force of 12 million, but we drafted 20 million. That means 8 million got out of it. I write about racism because it's in the context of the guys that I'm writing about. When I got to writing about people and had their letters and other documents, man, it was great. I say this not to be dismissive or silly. It's orgasmic. It really is orgasmic when it goes. I've never had a feeling when, man, this thing is rocking and rolling. I see it. I see it. I see where I'm going. And it's why I write. It's a beautiful feeling.
You articulated the confidence of writing well. What represents the most confident you've felt writing and the least?
I have to say there were moments in the Mosquito Bowl when Friday Night Lights got going, and there was a huge misstep. I wrote 30,000 words. I was still in Odessa, where the book takes place. I needed distance from it. I didn't have it. I wrote 30,000 words, basically portraying the town of Odessa. I sent it off to my editor. Normally, you're the editors. You know, they have a few martinis. They take a couple of weeks to get back to you. It may take a month. She called me the next day. I said, all right. And she basically said, when are you coming to New York? I said, I don't know, a month. She said, how about tomorrow? I flew tomorrow. She took the 30,000 words and she said, look, I don't want to offend you, but at the rate this book is going, it's going to be longer than the rise and fall of the Third Reich. And Odessa is not Nazi Germany. And literally, Dan, we sat down in her small office. We used index cards and she sort of grilled me. It was almost spontaneous. What characters are we writing about? What games are we writing about? Why are we writing about the games? What's the social significance? How do they advance the narrative? And I saw it then on a corkboard. I saw the pieces rip through it. Once I got a good outline down and I could see it with those index cards, it was a blast. It really was a blast. It was my first book. I was 33 years old. And you're not going to have a feeling like that again, because the success was ridiculous. I just got an email today from someone in France who wants a copy of the book. I mean, it is the book that won't die. So I'm hoping the Mosquito Bowl, you know, maybe takes the edge off that. I don't know.
The grand majority of people never even get one like that. But to have that be your first, I wonder what happens with the emptiness of the afterword.
It's gotten better. There were times in my life where it was very, very hard, because I think we all want to move forward in life. We all want to, those of us who are ambitious, and many are, we want to top what we've done. I mean, that's part of life. Look, I knew the book is sold close to 2 million copies. It took off. I don't brag. It's iconic. Friday Night Lights is part of the vernacular. I knew I'm not going to top that. And there were moments where I was really, really despondent and depressed. My second book was about Ed Rendell when he was the mayor of Philadelphia trying to save the city. I knew 2 months going in, this book is not going to have anywhere near the success of Friday Night Lights. I don't know if it's going to have any success. I could not write for 3 months, which is when I went to a psychiatrist and I could put on antidepressants and anti-anxiety, because I was really blocked up, and it helped. And then my father said, look, I think that's it, Buzz. I think you're feeling sorry for yourself. I think that's a good problem to have. it's a good problem to have that you've written a book that for whatever reason took the nation by storm. So just move forward and stop comparing it and be proud of it. Don't be dismissive of it. Be proud of it. And so finally, at the very ripe age of 67, I'm proud of it.
Well, when did that happen, though? When did you arrive at something closer to peace with all of that?
I would think, I'm trying to think, maybe 10 years ago, maybe 15, 10 or maybe less. I wrote another book that did well about the art of managing with Tony La Russa, and that did well, and that was a bestseller. So at least that made me feel better. But, you know, my life has had a lot of ups and a lot of downs. I've gone through phases of life. You know, I had a weird time in there. I don't know if you've seen the documentary. I kind of hope it happens.
No, I have, and I want to talk to you about that. You've gone out of your way to show your life to people with...
Well, I have, and I felt at the time that was important. I think it maybe was too intimate, but I wanted to show people, you know, that we all have appetites. A lot of this was about my sexual proclivities, good or bad, but we have appetites, and we have things in our lives, some you're ashamed of, but some you should not be ashamed of. But I was reeling at that point in my life. Vanity Fair, they had The Purge. Everyone I knew was gone, including Gregory Carter. I did not, this book idea was percolating, but it wasn't formed. I said, what am I going to do with my life? You know, I'm on my own. I have nothing. And in a sense, I feel there was a certain self-destructiveness in being so intimate, why I kind of admire it. And then I said, you got to go back to your roots. You got to go back to what you're good at. You know, you've gone over here, you've written for television, you've written memoirs, you've written this, you did a book with LeBron, a book with Caitlyn Jenner, none of which were really satisfying at all. And I said, this idea came to me, and I think I don't want to be dramatic, but it righted my life and brought me back to what I love and what I'm really good at.
When you say you were blocked up for months, what was it? Pressure? The pressure of having to meet what it is that you did that was unprecedented at 33?
Part of it, there was a lot of sort of soul searching. I wish, at one point I said, I wish I had written this book when I was in my 40s. I wish I had written other books, and this sort of came in the natural progression. I'm 33 years old. This thing is going to sell 2 million copies. This Friday Night Lights is going to be a movie. It's going to be a television show. And as I'm doing A Prayer for the City, some of that I didn't know. I said, this thing's not going to fly. It's not going to fly. What's the constituency for a book about a mayor of a big city? What, five other big city mayors? And I couldn't go forward. I was blocked. I kept saying, it's not going to fly. It's not going to have anywhere near this test. Are you going to be, and I actually said this to myself, are you going to be the literary equivalent of the great high school quarterback who goes to state and then never plays again? Is that what you're going to be?
Oh, my God.
So you went through my mind a lot.
Were you dealing with fraud stuff? Were you dealing with, I'm an imposter? You have this successful book that's a monster, and you're like, are people going to realize that I can't do this every time?
I didn't. It's a good question. I didn't feel like a fraud, but there was a part of me that said, look, I can't do this every time. So I would see reviews. I even saw one today, actually. You know, not as The Mosquito Ball is a nice book, but it's not as entertaining as Friday Night Lights. Well, you know what? I'm sorry that World War II, and people dying and getting shot and killed is not as entertaining as Friday Night Lights. And I will take that under advisement. But it made me livid. Why compare it? They're apples and oranges. And, you know, then I go through, oh, God, 33 years old. I'm now 67. 40 years have passed. I want this book to do well. But, you know, I got to be zen about it. It's not going to have the same success. It just isn't. But I'm really proud of the book.
Buzz, I want to shake your shoulders and tell you at this age to stop getting livid because someone has written a sentence of criticism about your book.
You can't help it. You're the same way. What are you talking about?
No, I can't read that stuff anymore. I'm not going to be made angry by some person who doesn't understand how hard it is to write a book and how much you poured into it. Like, I'm not going to be made angry. I've thought since I've known you that you have an anger problem. And so I want you to not be as angry about shit that doesn't matter.
I'm much better. I promise I'm much better. But you're right. I shouldn't read it, but it made me livid. I spent 5 years on this thing. This review, if it took 15 minutes, that's probably too much time. 15 minutes, it was terrible. It was in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. I forget the guy's name.
Still hurts, though. Still hurts. If you read that stuff, it'll hurt. Like, why are you taking time? Why are you taking 15 minutes to be cruel to me when I poured 5 years into this and you have no idea how much I care about this project? You know, you have no idea this bit of art, what it took to be meticulous, obsessive, crazy to sculpt this so that you could write, so you could burp out 15 minutes of diarrhea about it's not quite Friday Night Lights.
Hey, will you do me a favor? Will you call this guy right now? That was an excellent risk.
All right, let's call
this guy and tell him, because you're right.
All right, let's.
5 years of my life, 5 years doing nothing, and to dismiss it. Well, some reviewers are not going to be great. Some are going to be great. Some people spend time. They read the book. This guy did. It was just superficial crap. And I shouldn't have read it, but it's so tempting. It's so hard to stay away from it, because the internet, you know what's out there. What are people saying? What are people not saying? But believe it or not, I let it go. When I wrote A Prayer for the City in the 90s, people would mention Friday Nights. I would get on the phone and call them and rip them a new one. And I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to complain about the guy on national radio on a podcast.
Don't just do that. Whittingham, in order to give the listener a possible payoff here in the next 20 minutes, I would like for you guys to find on the internet who this writer was who ripped Buzz Bissinger's book here unacceptably, The Mosquito Bowl. And let's see by the end if we can have him on. In the next 20 minutes, find the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette writer who wrote this.
Okay.
Hunt them down and have them talk to Buzz. When you turned in Friday Night Lights at 30,000 words, it's a first draft, and you're called in. Was that a painful session, or were you worried about it? Or if the book had come out in that form, would it have been any kind of special if it had come out in its original form?
No, it would not have. It would have been anything close, because it was ponderous. It was really slow. You know, as she said, this isn't Nazi Germany. It was taking forever. I wasn't writing about any of the characters. I wasn't writing about any of the games. I really wasn't setting the atmosphere of this town obsessed, with high school football. So yes, I was scared, but she wasn't. She said, look, this happens. It's the first book. You're going to make mistakes. What I worried was she was going to say, he can't do this. We're just going to cancel it. He can't do it. But when I saw those index cards aligned and on that cork board, then I said, all right, I see it. I got to face the book. Sometimes, you know, you write and you don't really face it. You don't really get into it. You dart around because you're scared of saying, what do I really have? What do I really have? But I got over that hurdle. And then right away, this was in September, because it only took me about 3 months to write once I got into it. I said, all right, I see it. And then day after day, there was more and more confidence.
What were the impulses that you were feeding that cause you regret now when you think about doing the documentary?
I hurt people, and you know, I hurt my beautiful wife Lisa, who was amazing. That made me very sad. It made me very sorrowful. I just wondered if I had gone too far. It was only a second, but there was a pretty explicit scene of S&M. You know, I was in a body bag, and I was very uncomfortable with that. And then I realized I want to go private a little bit. I don't want to be known for the documentary. I want to go private. I want something that's my own little piece that I can do and then let it launch into the world. And this became, the Mosquito Bowl, set in World War II and ultimately set in the horror of Okinawa that I think very few people are aware of.
We don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. I'm not interested in making you further uncomfortable.
I'll talk about anything.
Well, I'm just asking you about the impulses you were feeding. When you look back at the decisions that you made, I'm asking you why you think you decided to be that vulnerable with a public that can't be trusted with your vulnerabilities.
Well, that's an excellent way of putting it. I felt at the time that one of the things, we're not very honest. We're not very honest about ourselves. We're not honest about other people. We don't really express things that many think are taboo but are not. So one of the impulses was, I want to say these things. Now, granted, to display my marriage like that, I thought was terrible, but these are, I don't know how else to put it, sexual impulses inside me. They're not bad, and they're a part of me, and they're very, very hard to shed when you've had them all your life. So this is an exploration that I have to take, even if it ends up to be a disaster. And that was my, original impulse. But you know what it's like. You do it, and then you see it, and then you say, whoa, I don't know if I should have said this stuff, but you know what? It's out. I did. It's over. I will say that a lot of people got a lot out of it. I mean, I got a lot of letters saying, you know, thank you. Thank you for expressing this. Thank you for telling it. Thank you for your candor and honesty. It's helping. So that was great. But ultimately it was just too private. And to hurt Lisa like that, I will not ever forgive myself. And the great news is we're together. We stay together and our marriage is stronger than ever. So it had a great result.
But won't ever forgive yourself, huh? That the remorse is that strong. Just didn't know what the damage was that you were doing by I imagined wanting to be less alone with this and wanting to make people who are alone with this feel like it's not quite as abnormal as they might think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wanted to get that across, but you know, when the documentary veered into them, I heard a beautiful, smart, singular, spectacular woman. And I can't forgive myself for that. I think she has. I hope she has. She has forgiven me, but I won't. And so when I saw that on the screen, when I saw the damage that was done, that, you know, spiritually killed me.
You don't strike me as someone, though, on even the best moments that is doing a whole lot of going easy on himself.
Oh, God, no. It's sort of pathetic, really. I can't. My wife says, give it a break. Stop beating yourself up. I mean, I've been in therapy for over 20 years, and that's a really strong litany, and I don't want to get into the psychology, but being hard on myself, beating myself up is my default position. I'm comfortable with it, as strange as that sounds. I'm not comfortable with being optimistic. I'm not comfortable with sort of sliding through, because part of it, Dan, is you got to be hard on yourself if you want to succeed, if you want to do something special. You can't coast. You got to pound away. But for me, it's become extreme. And in doing the Mosquito Bowl, now it's launched. It's launched today. I'm proud of it. I think it's got a great narrative. I think it's important. I think it's poignant. I think it's tragic as I take these men through, some of whom live and some of whom die. But I've been beat, you know, it's not going to, I'll tell you what I say, not going to do well. Get used to it. It's no Friday Night Lights. Get used to it. And you screwed this up. You screwed that up. Why'd you do it? And this is the running chorus through my head.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Is there anything that you would like to do over about Friday Night Lights? What things, as you're meticulous about perfecting things, is there anything that you'd go back and change? Or are you like, no, that came out pretty much a masterpiece when it was done?
The thing I would change is, looking back, and I've never read it over, I've read parts of it, but the thing I would change is I thought it had a great youthful exuberance, and I think that was one of the reasons for its success. But some of the prose was a little bit purpley. I think some of the prose was over the top. So maybe I would have screened some of that out. But no, I mean, you know, once I got going, this was the book I set out to do, in the sense that I'm proud of what I did. I had no idea what would happen during that season. I think I was the luckiest person alive because of all the ins and outs of the season, the racism to the great running back, Boobie Miles, almost not making the playoffs, the surreality of the coin toss to see who got in, almost advancing, going all the way, the Dallas Carter team that was all black that got kicked out of the playoffs, and seven of their kids went to prison after they won the state championship. Everything broke right. And, you know, you get that once in a life.
I enjoy talking to authors for a lot of reasons, but one of them is because they invest so much in the meticulousness of some subject matter to pour in for years of investment to gather an expertise over what it is that they're chronicling. So I ask you these questions about some of your seminal work, asking you to define for me what you learned, okay? A one or two item learning, because I know a lot of things get learned, but call me Caitlin. When you do that book, what did you learn?
Call me Caitlin?
Yes.
Nothing. Very little that I did not know, because I had done the Vanity Fair piece on Caitlin. I gotten to know her well. Caitlin poured her heart into the book, but it was missing something. It was missing something. Personally, I think it was missing introspection on the part of Caitlin, and that was not something I could make up, and I'm probably too honest. I knew when the book was sold, her star was fading. There was so much controversy about her, much of which I don't think was fair, particularly in the transgender community. If it wasn't for Caitlin, I'm not sure we would know what the word transgender is. But I didn't learn much. The reader may have learned a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but you know what? And it's her book. It's her book. And that's humiliating. And some have done it brilliantly. I'm sure you read the book on Andre Agassi that was ghostwritten by J.R. Moore.
It's the best biography I've ever read, not just sports, ever.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Andre had a wife that was fascinating, and he went deep with it. And J.R., I don't know if you've read The Tender Bar. I mean, The Tender Bar is a fabulous book.
Yes, excellent.
As well. So it can be done. But I kind of like, she was much more cooperative at LeBron. She really worked, but it was missing something. It was missing something that I couldn't get. We've talked about shooting stars. You know, LeBron, when your main character's not into it, and you can tell he's distracted, and you can tell he really doesn't want to do it. Now I could rely on other characters because of the nature of the story. It was these five kids coming together in high school, but I didn't get at it. I always felt you're not getting at it. I got to tell you, Buzz, your head's not really there. Your head is not really there. And so I didn't really do the kind of reporting that I thought I should do. You know, Friday Night Lights, I learned a real slice of Americana, a real slice of American life. I had no idea the type of pressure that was being put on these kids. It was much worse than I thought. I had no idea about the kind of racism that there was in Odessa that sadly exists from coast to coast. You know, Prayer for the City was about a hero. I had a great appreciation for politics because of the work of Ed Rendell. The Mosquito Bowl was about commitment, incredible sacrifice, what duty really means, and the willingness of these Marines, and not just Marine, any seaman, any soldier, to be willing to sacrifice their lives. And what I learned is just how young some of these guys were who died, of the 65 who played in a game, 15 died. Dan, they were young. They were kids. They might have been in their 20s. But, you know, I kept a picture of one of them, a character named Dave Schreiner, next to me as I wrote, and I would look into it. And I wouldn't get weepy, but there would be tears in my eyes because he was a beautiful man. He was a two-time All-American from Wisconsin. He loved his family. His family loved him. He was in love with his fiance. And I won't tell you what happened. You can pretty much guess. But to look into his eyes, at such a waste. I know it wasn't. But part of me says, what if it hadn't happened? Because it was, what if it hadn't happened? What if he had not jeopardized himself on Okinawa? What if these 15 guys had gone that way instead of this way? Would they still, you know, would they still be alive? But this happened constantly in World War II, and there wasn't a single man who said, "The hell with it, I'm going to Rhodesia. I ain't going to fight in this." They did, knowing, particularly in Okinawa, that the odds of getting wounded or killed were way more than 50%. Look, 82 days in Okinawa, 240,000 people died, close to 150,000 civilians, virtually the entirety of the Japanese army, 90 to 100,000, and you know, 14,000 Americans died. The Navy, because of kamikaze pilots, lost more people than in any battle, 5,000. The Marines, 4,000. Casualty rate, over 50%. And this became one of the, I think, a primary reason why Truman decided to drop the atom bomb. He was shocked by the casualty rate, and then you're attacking the Japanese homeland where, you know, they're going to be more fanatic than they've already been. And he said, that's it. I'm not going to lose another boy on foreign soil. I'm not going to do it. Okinawa was held. The Japanese had a great strategy. Their only strategy was to kill as many Americans as possible. And I'm not going to let this happen. I am simply am not. We have to end this war for the sake of these young, vibrant men who died. And look, they weren't perfect. No one's perfect. America wasn't perfect. We still have shameful things that we have never let go of, our attitude about immigration, race in America. But ultimately, and I think this is true of World War II and true of the best of us, they were ordinary men rising to extraordinary circumstances. And I think in many ways, that's the best thing you can ever say about someone, really reaching beyond yourself to sacrifice, to protect, to save the fellow man in your foxhole. And by the way, they're not fighting for patriotism. They're not fighting for the flag, except in some sort of abstract way. I think many of them didn't know where Japan was. They certainly didn't know about these islands as they're going towards the Japanese homeland. They fight for each other. You fight for the man next to you. You fight for the man you've lived with in the tent. And that was so stirring. And when I say fight, that means a willingness to die. And you're in a foxhole. The Japanese have great snipers. And you turn, you hear a whoosh. Bullets don't make a lot of noise when they go through the skull. You hear a whoosh. And the guy next to you has been hit. You see the hole through the helmet. I don't have to tell you the rest. They want to regret. But he's dead. But you don't stop. You can't stop. You don't cry. You'll cry later. But you have to move on. You have to move on, even though it's somebody you love. Because, you know, there are only two spheres of life, I think, where men are really allowed to openly love. One is sports. Did you see them? They love each other. And one is war, which I think is interesting. Those are the two arenas. And those Marines, any soldier who fights, you love one another. This is your family. And to see your family obliterated on a battlefield, I can't imagine anything worse.
The new book is The Mosquito Bowl, A Game of Life and Death in World War II. What else did you discover about your father? And did this bring you closer to him?
You know, when I discovered, once again, this was sort of accidental, that he not just had been in Okinawa, which I knew, but had been a rifleman, which meant he was on the front lines, because that's what riflemen did. They were in combat. I was struck by that. This was never intended to be, you know, a search for my dad, and it's not. I do write about him at the beginning. Dan, I was so proud of him. The more I learned about what these men went through, the carnage, the horror, the blood, the sadness, the tragedy, but also the uplift. There was a lot that was uplifting. I was so proud of his sacrifice. By the way, I don't know why my dad became a Marine, because he was drafted by the Navy. And, you know, a lot of the Navy jobs are fairly cushy. But typical of my dad, he said, well, I don't want to die on a ship. So you join the Marines? I mean, what's wrong with that picture? And I wish
Bissinger, a whole lot of conflicts roiling within. He passed that down to his son.
That he definitely did. Right. Well, I don't want to die in a ship, so I'll go join the Marines. Good move, Dad. Really good move.
The Bissingers might be able to be accused of some self-destructive behavior.
I think that's right. We should be in a wrestling match together, my father and I, to see who can be the most negative. But he went through hell and he came back. And I just wish at a certain point when he was older and I was older, I would have probed. I would have asked more, but I could tell he didn't want to go there. My mother related an incident. There was a small get together of family, and somehow the war came up and he had to leave. He had to leave the apartment, go downstairs and smoke a cigarette. So I said, that's his private zone and I don't want to violate it. But my pride in my dad has multiplied exponentially. And that's a wonderful thing. That's a wonderful thing in anything you write, to sort of rediscover someone you thought you knew, but in some ways did not.
I've got a couple of more questions here. I know you're pressed for time, so I wanted to ask you about the piece you did in 1998, Shattered Glass, an expose on the career of New Republic writer Stephen Glass, who was making a bunch of shit up. Anything to be learned from in that expose that was worth carrying around 30 years later?
Well, you know, there's no substitute for crass ambition. And I knew this kid a little bit, and nothing was going to stop this kid. But, you know, it's amazing how human beings can manipulate the system and almost get away with it. He snookered everybody. Now, he was writing for the New Republic, and I forget now, I think almost 20 of his stories were made up or parts were fictionalized. But New York Times Magazine wanted them, NPR, George Magazine, Rolling Stone, and his genius. And by the way, there are very few people in the world I really do hate, but I do hate him. His genius was to know exactly what editors wanted. Because you know how it goes. I want a gotcha story. I want something that's revelatory. I want something that gets on page six. And he knew to a T how to do it until he finally went too far. And there was a reporter at Forbes online who finally said something's not right here. But he snookered for two years. He was the hottest young journalist in the country. And, you know, I guess I should have learned from it, just start piping stuff. And you know, maybe I'd have your job.
What was the reaction or the feedback that you remember or blowback to the GQ column that you wrote where you admitted to being a shopaholic and that expensive designer clothes that you spent like $600,000 or something in a couple of years on great looking clothes?
I don't know why I laughed. Unfortunately, that phase of my life is pretty much over. I wrote the story because I thought it was a story worth telling. I mean, once again, the kind of impetus was, hey, I have an addiction. This is how addiction works. I have a leather fetish, but a leather fetish is not a bad thing. Spending ridiculous amounts of money can be a bad thing. And I could sort of afford it, but frankly could not. And it's really hurting me now. So I wanted to sort of help others or in exposing myself, you know, let others see what sheer honesty is like. But I think there was something self-destructive about it, which I do. I didn't tell my kids. My son Caleb was a Kenyan and found out when someone said, God, what's with your dad? And he said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, that story in GQ, I mean, my God, everyone's talking about it. It sounded like he's gone insane. And there was stuff in it that was sexually explicit. I really hurt him. It took a while to recover. I didn't tell my other son. And literally the day that it came out, I was in rehab for what I would describe as an all-purpose breakdown. My wife was just not going in a good direction. And part of it was, I wrote a book called Father's Day about the relationship with my twin son who had trace brain damage. Once again, I liked the book, but it didn't really hit the marketplace like I hoped. And I was really depressed. And when you get depressed, I don't know how you handle it, but I act out. I get self-destructive. I don't like myself. And rehab, you know, it's not perfect. There's something gimmicky about it, but it actually did help my mood. I stopped being so blisteringly angry about everything. So I really have not seen what the reaction to it is, although I've been told by people there was a lot.
The rehab is for just all purpose being addicted to beating yourself up. Like what? Which is the addiction, or being addicted to being addicted to things? Like what? Or just,
well, there was an addiction. You know, there was certainly an aberrant addiction to leather. And look, leather for me signifies a certain sexuality. I was doing harm to myself. You know, I was doing harm. I was burning myself. I was playing around with things that, you know, could be really dangerous, you know, a hood. And if I could unzip it, you know, I would have choked myself to death. I was acting out. I just hate to say it, but, you know, I was screwing around. My wife was in Abu Dhabi at NYU. There was a 14,000-mile gap between us, or 14 hours. And you name it, I was doing it. I just felt going to a therapist once a week was not working. Something was really deeply, deeply troubled within me, and I had to try to sort it out. So, I mean, you know, it was a lack of impulse control, sexual addiction, self-harm, acting out. And, you know, for me, that was enough to get some really some consistent long-term help. So I was there for 60 days.
You're introspective and you are somebody who is really astute. Can you explain to me why it is that you have these roots that need to be so transparently honest about everything? Why do you have to show everyone everything?
You know, I don't, it's a great question. Certainly no one in my family has it. I'm surprised they still talk to me, actually. But it's been, I think it's a part of me because so people are so dishonest. People are afraid of things. People are afraid expressing things. You know, everything is taboo. You know, I still like to wear leather. I think they look cool in it. Maybe I do, maybe I don't. But, you know, I would get compliments from women and minorities who loved the way I looked. And white men would look at me like I was insane. And, you know, I said, guys, to myself, I'm just expressing myself. You're scared to express yourself. And we need to express ourselves. We need to get to honesty. If you get to honesty, then there's something to talk about. But so much of life now is, you know, is spin. Put a positive spin on it. What's the story you're going to tell? It's all about being, to me, disingenuous and dishonest. And I just don't want to be that way.
I don't know that there's anything, I don't pretend to know you, but I'm guessing there's not a lot that makes you angrier than dishonesty, given that you're such a zealot about making sure that you're being honest.
Yeah, I mean, when I see it, obviously we see it in politicians all the time, so that doesn't really count. But, you know, I'll listen to people. I'll hear things. Either they embellish or they embellish and they tell a story about themselves or something that they've done which really isn't true, or it's just outright, you know, lies about things. And look, I've lied. I know I've lied, and I'm not proud of it. But it's more this sense that we're not honest about ourselves, and we're really not honest with each other, and what would the world be like if we were and took the cover off things? Look, liking weather, spending $600,000 is somewhat extreme, but liking weather is not a bad thing. Exploring sexually is probably a healthy thing as long as you don't hurt people, and I did. Those are good things, and those are things to talk about. Because if you talk about them, then maybe people will say, you know what? As Caitlyn Jenner said, we all have stuff. We all have stuff in our closets, and I saw this in her ability, her honesty to say, this is who I am. That was very uplifting, and, you know, I learned from that, and I learned from, you know what? I need to be honest about myself to be authentic. I love authenticity, and that was something about the Mosquito Bowl. These guys were innocent, they were sweet, and they were totally, totally authentic, and it's one of the reasons, you know, I fell in love with them. I fell in love with the kids in Friday Night Lights who played football. Totally authentic. Odessa, a totally authentic place. And to me, those are the books and those are the memories that resonate and stay with you.
Appreciate your time. Appreciate your work. Appreciate your honesty. Last question on the way out. Was it a dryer that was going on throughout this interview or just you leaning back and forth in a chair that makes some noises? I don't know. Whittingham, my producer here, has been made crazy the entire time. And the audience who's been with us for 50 minutes has probably been looking around their house. What's making that noise in my house? Is it a dryer? Is it the chair?
It's the chair.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, hey. That's okay. I just need to point it out to the audience because we're covering rich and deep and dark terrain, and there was a distracting noise that sounded like some socks were making their way around in a circle behind you. Thank you, Buzz, for being on with us. We appreciate it.
All right, Dan. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vandercoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.